Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jobs, the markets, and on a Friday, beer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses. Learn more and receive a free trial at carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday of a week we'd all probably rather forget. This one's the 5th of August. Good as always to have you with us. Relatively speaking, today's jobs report was a bit of sunshine in what seems like a long stretch of downright evil economic weather. The Labor Department let it be known this morning that the American economy added 117,000 jobs last month, a bit more than anybody had been guessing. The unemployment rate dropped just a hair, down to 9.1%. But like I said, it's all relative. Today's report comes against a backdrop of other mediocre economic news, stock market plunges, as you know, and more debt problems than anybody can shake a stick at. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on how things are playing out in the actual economy.
Today's report is an improvement over previous months, so not bad, but not particularly good either, especially if you're looking for a job.
There's not much in there for that person,
says Heidi Shierholz, a labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute.
117,000 jobs added. It's just barely enough to keep up with normal growth in the working age population, not enough to start putting the backlog of unemployed workers back to work.
Nearly half of unemployed people have been looking at least 6 months for a job, and there are more than four job seekers chasing every open position. There is one bright spot, says Shierholz. Fewer people are filing unemployment claims.
We don't have evidence that employers right now are ramping up layoffs. So that's good news. We'll have to wait to see what happens with hiring in the months to come.
And what's been happening this week in the economy and the stock market isn't exactly encouraging for small business owners.
My name is Brian Kuehl. I have two custom retail lighting stores in New Jersey called Shades of Soho. Right now, I'm not looking to hire anybody, especially with yesterday. The idea is try to be as lean as possible and hopefully make, you know, as much money as possible right now and just be very cautious.
Darren Carter's in a good business, medical software, and his New York startup will be hiring soon, but
I'm also trying to find creative ways in hiring because I feel like now there are ways to supplement your workforce without necessarily committing to a full-time employee.
Clark Bremer is a builder in Minneapolis. The recent economic troubles just seem like more of the same for him.
My customers, of course, get spooked when their investments lose value, so I don't have enough backlog of work that I'd feel comfortable and confident hiring someone.
Not exactly a recipe for recovery-style job growth. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's tough to imagine a better setup for the next 4 minutes of the program than to say, man, am I glad that week's behind us. So without further ado, here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond are John Carney from CNBC, also our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, live, as it were, from New York. Next thing you know, guys, we're on Saturday night. I don't know. Hey, how are you?
Hey, Kai.
Carney, you there?
Right. I am here.
There we go.
Sorry.
All right. Nice of you to join us. All right. Well, since you were tardy, Mr. Carney, you get the first question, which, if I recall, happened to you last time you were on the broadcast. But anyway, without mentioning the phrase debt deal, I want you to explain to me why what happened yesterday happened, given that the economic news has been grim for a while now.
People, I think, were distracted for a long time by the huge debate we had in Washington over the debt ceiling.
No, I said don't say that.
I know, but right. That was what was happening. And I think when they actually got to focus on fundamentals, what they focused on was, wow, things are really a mess in Europe. And I think the economy, which we had been distracted from during the debt ceiling debate, came back into focus of the U.S. domestic economy. It's really bad. The numbers are really bad. The resolution of the debt ceiling debate is only going to make the economy worse. It's not going to improve the economy. And so I think once the light got shown back on the fundamentals instead of the big political debate, people started selling.
Heidi, do you agree with that?
No, I mean, let me, in some ways, I think it's a very neat argument, but let me be a little bit nihilist. I don't think they're connected. I don't think the market is connected to the economy. Yesterday, the Dow dropped 512 points. Mm-hmm. It looked like a total panic. And, you know, I will pay you all sorts of money I don't have to find me anyone who truly knows what happened.
Right.
No one really does. And so I think the market did what it did for reasons we don't understand, probably related just purely to psychology and panic.
That's not very reassuring, John.
There's a lot of guys, actually, the old school Wall Street guys who I speak to constantly bring up the fact that so much trading is done electronically.
Yeah.
There aren't the kind of professionals who used to work on the floor of the stock exchange, the specialists who used to kind of put a break on that kind of market action. They would go in, make a market. If there was a lot of selling, those mm-hmm. guys would start buying. And so the old timers say the market lacks balance and that we're going to get more and more of these days where the market rockets up or, like yesterday, you know, drops.
Yeah. Heidi, the jobs report that Mitchell was just talking about, small businesses not in a mood to hire. Can we take anything from this number today? What do you take, I guess, is the better question?
Well, I mean, the real number that everyone should be thinking about is that only 58.1% of American adults are now employed. You know, think about that for
say
a second.
That, wait, that is, say that. How can that be? 60% of American adults. Is that right?
Right. Not even 60. 58.1%. Yeah. No, it is. It is really dark. And so when you have economists kind of, you know, banging on about whether we're in a recession or we're not in a recession, you know, trust your own eyes on this. Right. We don't have, you know, we have 40% of people. We don't know if they're employed, partly employed, you know, not in the market at all.
Okay.
But only 58% are employed.
Some of those people are retired, you know, and
right.
some of them aren't looking for jobs at
right.
all. You know, there's a natural unemployment rate among adults that's not zeros. But
right.
but
the
is
general
very
context,
bad.
Right, John? The general context is grim. Yes.
Yes, it's very, very grim, and we're not creating enough jobs to even keep up with the natural population growth so that we're going to get more and more joblessness, even if we're not laying people off. We're going to accumulate people.
Yeah. Well, that gets me to the jobless recovery phrase and this thing that's been happening the last couple of days of, ooh, double-dip recession. I mean, John, where are you on that quickly?
Well, I'd say it's not a jobless recovery. It now looks a lot more like a recoveryless recovery. I'm not even sure if I would call it a double-dip recession. I think we had some very artificial growth ginned up by stimulus programs and Fed quantitative easing. But we're slipping right back into the recession that I don't think we ever really escaped.
Heidi, last word to you. What do you say on that?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's basically we have had the 2 years of magical thinking, and now they're over.
Heidi Moore from our bureau in New York, John Carney from CNBC. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
The market action today, as the three of us were just talking about, was, in a word, wild. Down and then down some more and then up and then mixed by the bell, honestly. Volatility like that makes for great headlines, lots of excitement. But for most real people, it's just plain scary. Visions of retirements and college funds evaporating, things like that. So this morning, we sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith out to talk to investors and investment managers about how they're dealing with all the market drama.
Investors are having all kinds of reactions. There's nervously watching and waiting, like New Yorker Derry Go.
I don't know what to do because, you know, my stocks are really falling apart. You know, it's really hurting me at this point.
There's the take the bear by the horns approach, like Loretta Strang in New York.
I pulled it. I pulled it out of the stock market, put it into just into money markets. I'm not going to sit there and watch it just disintegrate.
And then there are the Zen masters, like Gibran Begum in Los Angeles.
I actually took a look at them. They were down 5 or 6% from yesterday. But you stay the course, a year or two from now, they'll be up twice that much.
New York money manager Stephen Lieb says he keeps hearing one thing over and over again.
Are we back into 2008?
Lieb says we're not. Still, he says it's hard to give advice at the moment because the swings in the market have been so dramatic.
It sort of has to shake up your belief in long-term investing. It really does.
Lieb says this latest market swing is a big correction. Ken Rogoff is an economist at Harvard. He says the market's moved too high, too fast, thinking we'd bounce back from the recession.
In a way, we have never exited this great contraction. We're slowly coming out of it. But during this period of slow growth, you're more fragile. Things can move faster up and down than in a more stable situation.
Nervous buying and selling by all kinds of investors is making market fluctuations worse. Rogoff says this volatility will rule for the foreseeable future. Bill Stone is chief investment strategist with PNC Wealth Management. He says volatility on Wall Street can be a big drag on Main Street.
The volatility may in fact cause people to delay decisions for fear, not make investments that they'd like to make, not hire the people they were thinking about hiring.
In the meantime, investors are pretty much stuck watching it all play out.
Every 30 minutes, I check just to see how I'm doing. So, yeah, it's all red. Not a good sign.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Every 30 minutes, I don't know, that's a lot of checking. Wall Street today, as I mentioned, decidedly undecided. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One proximate cause of all the market angst yesterday, and that's proximate, not the only cause, was yet more worries about the debt crisis in Europe, Spain and Italy in particular. So you'll be glad to know Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's on the case. Berlusconi said today the group of seven finance ministers will meet soonish to talk things over. There was a conference call this morning between the leaders of Germany, France, and Spain on the topic du jour. President Obama spoke to German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy about the matter again today. But Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London the end of the Eurozone crisis still nowhere in sight.
In every financial panic, political leaders feel the need to soothe investors' shattered nerves. That task fell today to a man once described as reassuringly boring, the Finnish politician and European Economics Commissioner Olli Rehn.
I would, in fact, encourage now everybody to stay calm and breathe deeply and see that the economic recovery is going on.
But Olli's placid Nordic manner could not disguise the fraying tempers among Europe's political elite. The German economy minister dismissed a speech by Europe's top bureaucrat as frantic ranting. And the Italian authorities rather overreacted to the crisis. They raided the offices of the two main ratings agencies that have been critical of Italian government bonds. Julian Pendock is with Sennhaus Capital.
So now you have politicians running around shooting the messengers, which is never something that gives the markets much confidence.
But what's really undermining market faith in the Eurozone, says economist Raoul Ruparel, is the conviction that Europe is not prepared to bail out Italy with its $2.5 trillion of public debt.
There's no way that any German government or even most of the northern European governments could sell that to their electorate, and there would be widespread political unrest within Europe.
There is no obvious easy way out of the mess. One analyst has compared the Eurozone to Mr. Micawber. The Dickens character was heavily in debt but always hoped that something would turn up. In his case, it did, but he was a work of fiction. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Those of you who live in pedestrian-friendly cities may not believe this, but there are people from more car-centric cultures, Los Angeles, yes, just for instance, or Houston, Texas, where it's nothing to drive like a mile on a quick errand instead of just hoofing it. Part of that's force of habit. Part of it, though, is a lack of inviting places to walk or enough safe routes to ride your bike on. In Houston, though, one group is trying to change that block by artistic block. From KUHF, Wendy Siegel reports.
Zach Lockram rolls a small paint striping machine down Holman Street in Houston.
There we go. Bike lane. So now we will go down and put the little bike guy in the middle, too.
Within hours, that bike lane will be painted blue. It's all part of a 24-hour stunt to turn a boring urban block into a vibrant one overnight. Lockram and more than a dozen volunteers will pick up trash and set up food stalls and cafe seating on the sidewalk. Jay Crossley is an organizer with Houston's Better Block Project, a movement that started in Dallas and is now spreading to other parts of the country.
We're trying to show just how we can transform a neighborhood through transforming the street.
They're also adding some greenery with young trees and purple flowers to spruce up the block. And they're doing this even though it'll all be taken down and washed away tomorrow.
The Better Block is a temporary art installation.
Andrew Howard is a transportation planner in Dallas. He and a friend came up with the Better Block project last year. Howard calls them urban defibrillators, saying they can bring a flatlining street back from the dead. He hopes the event will create a sort of virtuous circle. If there's more foot traffic, more stores will open, and with more stores comes more foot traffic.
Maybe they come there because of the art gallery, but then they find out, there's a great dress shop, there's a really nice coffee shop there as well, and in between those two there's a cafe. Then we've captured them and got them before they've gotten back into their car.
But can changes that are washed away the very next day have any kind of lasting effect? Howard says they already have. Since the very first Better Block a year ago in Dallas, two businesses have taken up leases on that street. It had impressed the Dallas City Council, which has since hired Howard's urban planning firm to design a walkable public plaza on what used to be traffic lanes. Howard says the car-free space will be dotted with trees and benches to encourage people to hang around.
So theoretically, it's supposed to fit 12 bikes.
Back in Houston, the crew is nailing together pieces of wood to make a temporary bicycle rack. Paul Nicosia, another Better Block organizer, surveys all the work that will be torn down in a few hours. He insists the block's facelift will prove to locals that it is possible for Houston to become walkable. But more than that, he hopes to catch the eye of the politicians who can actually make these changes permanent on blocks around the city.
What we show today may not happen just as we show it, but if we can get this to happen in another spot in the city, and then another, and then another, and then all of a sudden, it becomes second nature to all of the design professionals, all of the city officials.
He says pedestrian-friendly streets make for more active communities. Better blocks are popping up in Tulsa, New York, and elsewhere. The challenge, though, is to convince the right people that it also makes economic sense. In Houston, I'm Wendy Siegel for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There is definitely a stigma attached to cans.
Beer. Good beer. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, it was close, but after one of the wildest rides it's had in a while, the Dow Industrials ended in the black. Just rose 60 points, 0.5%, closed at 11,444. The NASDAQ didn't do quite so well, lost 23 points today, nearly 1%, ended at 25,32. The S&P 500 dipped into the red, finished down 0.1%, 11,99. For the week, the Dow drained 5.8%, the NASDAQ off 8%. The S&P 500 bled itself 7% dry. Bank stocks took a veritable beating today. Bank of America withdrew more than 7%. Citigroup dumped 4%. Tech stocks took a hit, too. Both Apple and Microsoft marched down 1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose for a change. 2.55% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, online automatic backup designed for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically backs up files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other problem, files can easily be recovered. More information and a free trial by visiting Carbonite.com using the code Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Northeast Asia Economic Forum kicks off its annual conference in Honolulu. It's also the first day of the 93rd PGA Championship in Johns Creek, Georgia. Recovered from an earlier injury, Tiger Woods will be competing. And actor Dustin Hoffman turns 74. Definitely 74. I'm Catherine Roberts.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Census Bureau told us not too long ago that homeownership in this country has fallen to the lowest level in more than a decade. Not to cast aspersions on the good people at the Census, but a better time frame for that might be 4 decades. Because if you count all those people who aren't paying their mortgages right now, homeownership is as low as it's been since 1965. That's the analysis from Morgan Stanley. And the way the U.S. housing market is right now, the question that follows is that such a bad thing? Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
The official homeownership rate is about 66%. Minus those delinquencies, you get 59.7%. Morgan Stanley's Oliver Chang says foreclosures take so long these days, they're slow to show up in the numbers.
So we believe that the 7.5 million people that are delinquent probably should not be counted as homeowners because in a more normal environment, they would already no longer be a homeowner.
No matter how you measure it, home ownership has fallen from its official peak, 69% in 2004. Chang says as a result, the U.S. is becoming a society of renters.
The big question here is, why do we care so much? What is wrong with renting?
That's analyst Christopher Thornburg with Beacon Economics. Advocates of the tarnished American dream say ownership creates more stable communities and essentially forces families to save money. But Thornburg, a homeowner, says buying a house is sort of like buying a flat-screen TV. It's a luxury, not a necessity. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
For our summer book series this week, we've heard from an author, a biomechanical engineer, a video gamer, and a chef. We asked them to share books that helped inspire their careers. Today, we end the series with a little frosting on top, courtesy of the co-founder of Crumbs Bake Shop, Mia Bauer.
My favorite book is Edith Wharton's Age of Innocence, and I've read it over a dozen times. The novel is set in New York City at the turn of the century. At first, the story seems completely disconnected from the life of a modern-day businesswoman, but the themes are so universal that they still resonate. Miss Wharton devotes considerable time detailing the food preparation in the kitchens of grand houses. Pages and pages are filled with exquisite meals and how they are prepared, served, and consumed. I read these pages over and over because the beauty and artistry come to life, and I appreciate the extensive planning and organization. There are endless details that come into play when getting a retail business off the ground, and for the same reasons I marvel at them in The Age of Innocence, I enjoy taking care of them in my business, Crumbs Bake Shop. There was a time when social activity centered around meals, and people came together to converse and enjoy food prepared at home. This is the memorable experience I hope to conjure for our customers when they walk in our stores. I had a very clear picture of how our store should look and feel and the kind of unique, quality baked goods we should sell. Yet, perhaps the most profound influence The Age of Innocence had on my decision to open a business was the promise I made to never live a life of regret. I did not want to be Countess Olenska, who must sacrifice the things she loves, or worse, Newland Archer. He lives out his days with aching regret because he must do what's expected of him. I abandoned a successful career in law to pursue a dream, despite how many times I could hear the shock and disapproval in people's voices. But I knew if I didn't make the attempt, I would always wonder, what if?
Mia Bauer is the co-founder and vice president of Crumbs Bake Shop. Take a minute to drop us a line. Send us your book thoughts as well. Letters at marketplace.org. Yesterday was, for the uninitiated among you, International IPA Day. India Pale Ale, it's beer. And what I'm about to say is a matter of some debate, but good beer, really good beer, often comes from microbreweries. They typically cost more, but conventional wisdom holds microbrews are better than all that mass-produced fizzy yellow stuff, in part because they usually come in bottles. Conventional wisdom, however, is, as we know, not always right. Latoya Dennis reports now from WUWM in Milwaukee.
It's a Thursday night, and for college kids, the unofficial start of the weekend. Students from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee file into Gilbert's Liquor Store. Architecture major Casey Kearney heads straight for his beverage of choice.
Flying Dog.
That would be Flying Dog, a microbrew out of Maryland. Right now, it only comes in glass bottles, and Kearney says that's exactly the way he wants it.
Aluminum cans, that aluminum gets into the beer, and it does make it taste different.
Russ Phillips runs the blog, craftcans.com. It tracks and reviews microbrews.
There is definitely stigma attached to cans.
But a growing number of craft brewers is trying to change that. By Phillips' count, nearly 400 microbrews have turned to cans.
When I first started the website 14 months ago, it seemed like about every month I'd hear of a brewery that was going to can one of their beers. Now it's almost a daily occurrence from someone.
See, the cans are coming in up there, and they get washed right here, and then they move in.
Jeff Hamilton is president of Sprucker Brewing Company in Milwaukee. A few months ago, the company started putting some of its special amber beer in cans. He says the main reason for the switch was cost.
When it leaves here, it's considerably cheaper than the glass bottles, and I know that our distributors have passed that on, as have the retailers.
At a nearby grocery store, a bottle of Special Amber was going for $1.75, but a can was more than 50 cents cheaper. And Hamilton says the advantages don't end there.
Cans are much better for the beer. Beer doesn't like light, and beer doesn't like oxygen. And the can completely keeps the beer in the dark, and it's hermetically sealed so that no oxygen can get in.
Still, traditionalists like architecture student Casey Carney remain skeptical about beer in cans. But is there really a difference in taste? To find out, I asked Carney to take a blind taste test with Sprecher Special Amber.
All right. Why don't you try the glass on the left first?
Okay. We'll see.
All right. No, you can try the other.
I'd have to say that's the aluminum.
You think so?
I think so, yes.
Casey, you're wrong.
I'm wrong. Oh, no. Well, I definitely can tell that there's a difference, but I guess I was wrong.
Now, Kearney says, the next time he's in Gilbert's liquor store, he's going to give canned beer a second look. In Milwaukee, I'm LaToya Dennis for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, Wikipedia needs you. Jimmy Wales, the guy who started what has become the planet's fifth most visited website, says he's losing more contributors than he's picking up. It's a problem for what's supposed to be a user-created and maintained encyclopedia. Wales needs another 5,000 active contributors to get up to full strength. He is not, however, helping himself much when he describes the typical candidate as a 26-year-old geeky male. Let's go right ahead and raise your hand for that one, huh? That's Marketplace on a Friday from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 60 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 23 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 dipped 0.1%. Given yesterday, though, not so bad. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Ure. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the markets are doing the things that markets do, going up and down. But before you think about getting out, remember, you got to be in it for the long haul.
Goods that it would take you about $5,000 today will actually cost you $11,000 25 years from now.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.